As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Win over Chelsea to put City 13 points clear of their opposition and finish the weekend with an 11-point buffer to Liverpool in second place means it's been a pretty good few days. Welcome to this week's Why Always Us. This is your Manchester City podcast from The Athletic. I'm David Mooney. With me is Sam Lee. Hiya, Sam.
Hello.
It's a special show today, isn't it? It's number 100 that we've done, yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice one. Someone's got to get to 100 shows, haven't they?
I thought, just for this special occasion, Sam, I'd do a little bit of the number crunching last night before we started. You've done 92 of the shows, including today. I've done 98 of them, including today. So we've managed to, somewhere along the line, neither of us have managed to...
What happened when you weren't around?
You interviewed Nedham for one of them. I remember that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But I can't remember what the other one was.
That'll be it, won't it?
Yeah. Total runtime for the podcast so far is 3 days, 5 hours, 9 minutes, and 56 seconds.
Are you sure that's not the average runtime?
No, that's the... Well, it is when you're speaking, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you want to catch some of that 3 days, 5 hours, 9 minutes, and 56 seconds without the ads, then you can sign up to The Athletic right now. You can hear them all ad-free, or you can read all of Sam's stuff on City as well. Just sign up with the code MANCITYPOD. You'll get 33% off the price of a full subscription. That's theathletic.com/ManCityPod. Let's start this week, Sam. After last week and the discussions with Jim, who runs Man City Tactics on Twitter, about the problems that City had faced with Chelsea last season and how that changed at Stamford Bridge, we thought we'd bring him back for the first part of today's show. So welcome, Jim.
All right, lads.
Jim, good to have you back. I bet you didn't think it'd be back so soon after last week.
No, that's an honour. Yeah.
Talk us through, first off, you posted a thread on Twitter this week about how City dealt with Chelsea at the Etihad. Were you a little bit surprised at Chelsea's approach for this one, given that Thomas Tuchel had said already that in the Stamford Bridge game, his team were a bit too passive?
You know what? Not massively. Like, they switched back to 3-4-3, and it did look like they were passive, but it was encouraging them to play a pretty high line all the way through that first half. And City just got on top of them. It was just the way the match went. And it's the way it often goes. But I didn't think he set up that defensively. He set up like he usually does against City, like last season's version of Chelsea. And last season, the Carter's on the break a couple of times. And I think that was the difference.
Yeah, I mean, Sam, Jim said they caught City on the break a few times. It could have been different, couldn't it? I mean, Lukaku had a chance in the first half. There was that, obviously, the one where Stones slipped and didn't get the tackle in. If they'd have played that, you know, in a manner that wasn't really, really stupid, they could have done a bit better there.
Yeah, I was trying to work out. I remember thinking just before half time, I was like, if Chelsea were to nick one now, would I think it will be the end of the game? Would it be game over? I was like, no, because I think City are still on top. But obviously, it would have made it really difficult. And yeah, there were those chances there. And it's one of those, isn't it, where if Lukaku scores, then everyone's calling Thomas Tuchel a genius. And probably a lot of the people that are saying the title race is over and City are too good and whatever are probably going, oh, look at these problems on the counter-attack.
Yeah. Blown wide open again. Yeah.
Maybe not that, but it would also be, it would maybe more so like, oh, you know, struggling on the counter-attack. Are they going to win the Champions League? But, you know, that kind of thing. Just from those, those Lukaku chances, basically. But Guardiola kind of mentioned it afterwards. I quote tweeted an interview that he did on my Twitter the other day, and he was saying how, you know, Chelsea are so good at transitions, and he was like, when we scored from a transition, like, it's funny how it works, because obviously that's probably wasn't how he was expecting it to go.
Yeah. Jim,
maybe it was.
It was the left-hand side, wasn't it, that City were targeting?
Yeah, so it was pretty interesting, actually, because obviously they had Sarr and Alonso down that side, and they're probably pretty weak in terms of Chelsea's lineup. So what City did was adapt to the press. So instead of Sterling dropping onto Sarr, who's left-sided centre-back in the press, he dropped inside to Mark Kovacic, and City went 4v4 on Chelsea's central centre-back, right centre-back, and two defensive mids. So they basically tried to stop the build-up going down the centre and down the right-hand side and encouraged them to play to the spare man, who was Sarr. And on the whole, that worked pretty well. So, but what they did also was, last season, we had all the problems when the ball goes into the wing-back and City's full-backs engage. When the ball was going into Alonso, who's the left-sided wing-back, City were using Bernardo almost as a spare man on our right-hand side to engage Alonso. And that meant we could keep Walker in the back line. So instead of the 2v2s that we saw last season, if the ball was played upfield, Walker was there making a free man defence. So on the other side, Cancelo was pressing the wing back, was pressing as Aspilicueta, but it didn't really matter because we always had those free men in the back line for the most part. Anyway, at the beginning of the game, Walker did press Alonso a little bit, but we changed it very quickly.
Yeah,
and it worked pretty well.
Yeah, I was going to say, Sam, there was a weird kind of moment in the game where I think it was Ziyech was played through, and Walker basically turned on the gas and ran in and stole the ball from the halfway line back towards his own box. And I remember thinking at that point, oh, quietly, Walker's had a really, really disciplined game here. And it was a couple of minutes later when he knocked the ball forward to one of the forward players, and a fella behind me said, he's not had a good game today, Kyle Walker. And I thought, we're watching two different games here, because he's been really, really controlled in where he needs to be.
Yeah, it's funny how those kind of, well, that's the thing, isn't it? Like, we are watching two different games in terms of our, because it's what we're watching is kind of based on our kind of preconceptions and ideas. Like, there was a guy next to me who was like really disappointed with like everything Grealish did, but it's basically, and for this game and the season, he missed that great chance, and he missed a good chance at Watford, didn't he? And I think before that he missed a good chance at Leipzig, and there was a couple of others. But you think if he just scores a couple of those tap-ins, everyone's saying he's having a great season, and it was like the frustration had built at the weekend because he missed that chance, and then everything he did was kind of, oh, he should be doing this, should be doing that, and it's just your kind of perception of what's happening, and kind of, are you disappointed with a big moment? But yeah, with Walker, it's those moments, like you say, when he races back, because a lot of what he does, you know, he's not going to get loads of assists, he's not going to create a load of chances, you know, he's not Cancelo, so the most obvious things he does, and the most obvious things that your average football observer, including myself, is going to notice, is those chances where he kind of bursts back, and it makes you think. It just focuses your mind a bit, because the rest of it is easy to go under the radar. But like, he's been one of the key men of Guardiola's the whole time at City, like the whole trophy winning era since he came in 2017. He's been fundamental to that. And our Chelsea correspondent next to me, at that moment you mentioned, he was like, Walker's pace has been such a cheat code for City. And it reminds me of an article I think I wrote last season when City was, it was at the start of last season when they were struggling a bit. I was like, without that, like it that when that goes, when Walker's no longer there, that's going to really be noticed. And I think less so now because, you know, City are much better at dealing with counterattacks, but it is that in particular is really handy. And overall, he is a really important player, but just not in a particularly eye-catching way.
Yeah, Jim, I just wanted to ask about the way Chelsea played as well, as more than anything, the way City played. Did they just fall into City's trap here? Was this a case of them thinking of Tuchel switching back to what had worked last season and City going, actually, we've now got a plan to deal with that, so let's see what you've got, and they just didn't have anything to kind of counter it with?
Yeah, in terms of being forced into playing down the left, that happened a lot. So on the chances that they did create, actually, it's interesting to look at them because obviously, like you said, the first one where Lukaku goes through and tries to play in Ziyech, I think it is, that's some of Stones, sort of Stones slip. The one where he goes through and Edson makes the save in the second half is from a Cancelo gives the ball away trying to win it back to Kovacic in midfield and then he plays him through. There's not much you can do about that. But the one where Ziyech tries to put Lukaku in the first half, but he loses it. He overhits it. That came because they build up down the right and Sterling doesn't track Kovacic. So when the ball was played into Kovacic, who's on the right-hand side, De Bruyne is going mental at Sterling because he's stayed on the wing. So from there, they get it into Ziyech and he should have put Lukaku through. That's basically the last time Sterling drops off in terms of not marking Kovacic. So yeah, they did find it really difficult and being forced down that left-hand side, the amount of times that Sarr or Alonso put it in out of play or Bernardo pressured Alonso. So for the Grealish chance, Bernardo wins the ball back. Basically, he forces Alonso into a pass into Kovacic. De Bruyne nicks it off Kovacic and Grealish, you know, should score really. But yeah, City forced them into the way they played. Obviously, it didn't help that Lukaku didn't have his best game. I thought that was interesting in terms of Lukaku being linked to City and saying that City put a bid in for him. Not this summer, but the summer before. Because if you look at that match and you see some of his touches, some of his link-up play, how that fits in with City, it's baffling to me. But on Grealish as well, I thought his game was like, this was like a really interesting game for him because he had the opportunities to go in behind, which he did do, which he rarely gets playing for City because of the high line that Chelsea were keeping. And he does that pretty well. He goes in behind a few times, and he creates four shot creating actions, which is only second to De Bruyne. But there's zero big chances. So it's these cutbacks again. So he's getting in against Rudiger. He's coming back onto his right foot. He sets De Bruyne up a couple of times with chances, but they sort of half chances. And it's that playing on the wing again where is it working properly in terms of productivity? Yeah, he's keeping control out there. He's keeping possession. He is creating chances, but he's not creating those big chances. And there was an incident in the second half where he got fouled after Edison had played the ball out to him. And City took the free kick quickly. And he had Cancelo, who's sort of like in transition. And Cancelo is overlapping him. And he's cutting inside. He looks so dangerous. And Rudiger takes him down right on the edge of the box. And you think, wow, that was Villa Grealish there. But those circumstances.
I remember thinking that as it was happening. I was like, this is like the first time this has happened. Like, he's like a one-on-one, he's two-on-two kind of thing, but he's got support. He can go either side. He's running at them. There's space to go into. There's space behind. I swear this hasn't happened for him at all since he signed for Villa. And that was exciting. But like, it just goes to highlight. It's kind of the exception that proves the rule, isn't it? Like, that highlights everything that he can do it if he gets the opportunity, but it's just a different game now. He has to play in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Jim, just one final question for you. Do you think had Lukaku scored in the first half instead of trying to play it through to Ziyech and who was offside, or had he scored that one-on-one with Edison when it was still at 0-0 in the second half? Do you think City would have still had enough to carry on doing what they were doing to get back into the game?
Potentially, it would have been tough though. It's the difficult to create big chances again. Obviously, the goal that we score is you know a bit of a worldie from De Bruyne, and you know we do create chances against them. But it's one of the tougher matches in terms of breaking down that defence, and that's what they're there to do. You know they're there to defend against us, and you know hope that they get one on the break. When it's first v second in the league, it's a bit galling because you think let's have a contest, but we only get that out of Liverpool. That's just the way it is these days.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you very much for being part of this week's show again. Remind us where we can find you on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm at City Tactics, at City _ Tactics.
Lovely stuff, Jim. Thank you very much. No doubt we'll catch you again soon.
Great. Cheers, lads.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Now, for the second part of today's show, we're joined by the former City defender, Nedim Anua. Hi, Nedim.
Hello, how are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. Are you, well?
Yeah, I'm very well, mate. I'm looking at blue skies in the middle of January in Manchester, so yeah, I can't really complain, can I?
Well, I'm in Manchester as well, and I'm not looking at blue skies, so I'm not sure.
Manchester, my friend. North Manchester. It's where all the nice people are.
Lovely. Sam, how about you? Have you got blue skies where you are?
I have, yeah, in South.
All right, so. Fair enough. Fine, all right. Just me, then.
Do you actually live in Manchester, mate? What's going on there?
Open your curtains.
I technically live in Stockport, so maybe that's the problem.
I knew it. Another one of them.
Yeah, but there we are. Nedim, last time we had you on with both me and Sam, it was after the Stamford Bridge game in September, which is a really nice way to kind of bookend the last kind of few weeks of City. That match moved City to 13 points and above Chelsea on goal difference. This one moved City 13 points ahead of Chelsea. How impressed were you by Saturday?
Yeah, I was very impressed, to be honest, especially given the fact that, say, for Chelsea, that was such a big game for them in the sort of scope of the season. You know, that if they had any ambitions in terms of winning the league, then it kind of felt like they had to win. I think City could afford to not win, but Chelsea had to win. But then still, you didn't see the best performance from Chelsea. And I think a lot of that was down to the fact that City are who they are. So it was impressive. And, you know, you can never say never, but it seems like Chelsea are out of it now. And that game all but kind of confirmed it. And it's credit to City, like this run that they're on again. It just feels like a privilege. It's like deja vu. Like since I literally came back to England, I feel like all I've done is seen City just win games. You know, not like draw anything, just win games. So yeah. I think it's 12 in a row now. And last year got to, is it 16 in the league or something? Like it's outrageous. And as one thing we're seeing is that people, you can hope to match it, but the reality is that you won't. And as a consequence, if you can't, it means that you fall off and you're perceived to be sliding down. But the fact is, it's just because you're being judged by the highest bar possible. Yeah. So yeah, it's credit to City for doing so. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for it.
Sam, Nedim just said something that sparked off a thought in my head that I had before this game, was that I wondered if City were going to not win the title this season, if Liverpool and Chelsea both needed the other one to beat City as well as themselves. Do you know what I mean? Liverpool needed Chelsea to win and to win themselves. But I know the margin is still tight because that game in hand that Liverpool have got is kidding us a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Haven't they got two games? Oh, no, it's just one now, isn't it, after the Brentford game? It's funny, actually, that dynamic. I'm trying to think if that's been similar in previous title races where, yeah, the other two teams are both like, right, this one's clearly the strongest. We both need to beat them.
Wasn't that the case when Liverpool won the league and it's like everyone was united against Liverpool to try and just beat them wherever possible? Wasn't that a thing?
I think there was a lot of that. I suppose maybe there was a lot of that in the sense that there was a lot of City fans and Liverpool fans and Chelsea fans and a lot of people in the country didn't want them to win the league. So hoped that, you know, Watford or Sheffield United or whoever took points off them, but their keepers were too busy throwing the ball in their own net. it is like a three-way title race, isn't it? So it's like, but you have got two of them that are like, okay, well, you'd better beat this guy in recent seasons, there's been two at most, hasn't it, really?
Yeah, there was a moment, though, wasn't there, Sam, in lockdown when I remember thinking that one of the joys of not being able to go to the games and not being around for anything, the one thing I could take was I did quite enjoy that night online when it was confirmed Liverpool could only get 99 points and not top City's 100. There was something about that night. I found it, there was quite entertaining for a time that where we're all in this state of kind of existential crisis, you know what I mean?
I remember that being, I mean, you know, I said last week, and generally I really don't like to kind of contribute to like tribal stuff on Twitter. Like, I really don't want to be part of it. But I always think if somebody went back to that night, they could easily pull up a couple of tweets and say you're a hypocrite. And I am, but I do try and stay clear of it as much as possible. But on that night, it was impossible to resist, wasn't it? Yeah, because it was all about, you know, gonna, you know, City had this great season a couple of years ago. We're gonna do this and we're gonna do that, and just didn't in the end, did they?
That's the level we got to that year. Sam, we just heard from Jim how well City were pressing against Chelsea. I when I was sitting in the Etihad, I knew City were being really disciplined, as we said about Kyle Walker, but I didn't realise quite how smart the performance was until I kind of watched it back afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to keep on top of it from like a specific tactical sense, because that's what I'm trying to do now when I'm watching games. After 30 odd years of just following the ball around, I'm trying to actually work out what's happening and who's moving where and why they're moving there and that kind of thing. And I was speaking to Nadim about it during the game, so I was trying to, you know, keep an eye on who was doing what and why, and I had a good idea. But yeah, it's only afterwards. I always seem to find it much easier afterwards, to whether there's prompts or not, just to be like, okay, yeah, there's this and there's this. But yeah, it was, I mean, the obvious thing for me was the thing that really stood out, and I don't know if Chelsea were just too aggressive and Thomas Tuchel didn't want that overall, so they just stopped doing that, or they had intended to be aggressive. But after that night, that move after 90 seconds when Lukaku forced out or closed down Edison and got him to like play a rushed pass out, and City were like push back, and Chelsea were pressing them and trying to win it high up. But City did that thing where they just do a rondo on the middle of the pitch, and they had a chance for De Bruyne to play Grealish in on goal from the halfway line after like literally 90 seconds. And I just think, did Chelsea decide then that actually we can't be doing this? Or, you know, whether it was a conscious decision, because do you remember after the Liverpool game, Klopp said they got a bit spooked and they dropped off City and that was their problem. Like, I wonder if Chelsea did the same. But yeah, there was other things as well, like Chelsea being so compact across the middle to stop City playing through into midfield, but also being quite high. So City just went, okay, yeah, we're going to go over the top. Yeah. But yeah, often in terms of City's pressing and who's doing what, the way Jim broke it down there and on his thread on Twitter, and there's another thread on Twitter that he mentions, it's so clear. Like that, it at the moment, that's all kind of, that's a blur to me. Seeing the City players forcing players to pass down different sides and close down players in certain directions and that kind of thing, that's all a blur. So it's only afterwards that I can kind of catch up on that, really. But obviously you could tell there was a great intensity to it, and the way that the two sides were posing each other problems, and Chelsea were happier to go long for a bit and then stopped and all this kind of thing. That's why for me it felt like a good game until about 10-15 minutes into the second half, and I was like, this is just any game at the Etihad now. This is like City against anyone. You know, whether the only threat really is on the break or a mistake.
Yeah. Nedim, how hard is it to be that disciplined? Because Jim was saying that after one moment in the first half where Sterling didn't cut off the pass he should do, everybody kind of kept their positions and didn't deviate from where they needed to be to force that sort of Chelsea performance.
I think in terms of being disciplined, it's probably easier when you're the better side as well. And I think as well, say if Sterling's not in the right place one time, people will tell him that he's in the wrong place, whether it's the manager, whether it's the players on the field, whether it's the coaches or whatever. And everybody knows, like when somebody makes a glaring mistake into the people who are on the field, they will always let them know.
Yeah, I've been on the receiving end of that a lot. I know what it's like.
Well, there you go. Like, but interestingly, as Sam was alluding to there, you don't always see all that stuff from the outside because you don't know the plan. But 11 people on the field know the plan. So do the people on the bench and so on. So some mistakes aren't that obvious. But the thing about City, which I think makes them as good as they are, is they tend to correct things in real time and deal with things themselves in very specific ways because, you know, let's be clear, talent-wise, they're incredible, but it's that discipline that you speak about which goes a long way, but they know that that's the reason for the success. And I think in recent weeks, I've had to field a ton of questions about Grealish and his first season and this, that, and the other. And I think he'll be a good player for City and so on. But I think this year is going to be a lot of time for him trying to figure out why he's being asked to do what he's doing. And I think when you look around, if he looks around, he'll be able to see the why, because that's how they win the games.
Yeah.
Through showing, making sure that you show this person this way all of the time, not some of the time. Because, you know, if you do that, that's the first domino, because the next person's now going there and the next person's going there. And I think that's the thing for City and, say, really good sides. You know, when they're in possession, they can look great and control the ball and whatever, control the game. But they can do that just as well when they don't have the ball. And they're the worst teams to play against, because when they have a sort of cohesive strategy together in terms of how to win it back, how to make it hard for the opposition. Like, it's very hard to play against. And as Sam was saying there, when Klopp said Liverpool was spooked, I'm sure it was the same for Chelsea in some ways when City were attacking, because you can go and press. Like I love pressing. I love seeing my front line go and press, because then the midfielders get higher. Then at the back, you can get higher, because you know that the quality of ball into the strikers isn't going to be as good as if they're unopposed, because at the end of the day, whoever's got the ball on the field at the highest level is a good player. They can do something, yeah. But when they break the press once or twice, it's then very hard for you to think, well, I'm just going to go and do this again. You seem a little bit psychotic. Like, I'm going to do this. Oh, no, they've made it out again. And when you look around and you can't figure out why they've made it out, you tend to then make the adjustment to go back to, well, protect the goal first.
Yeah, sit deeper. Then,
exactly, yeah. They're not going to hurt us if they're in front of us, so maybe we sacrifice that. But as I say, credit City, the discipline's there, but like City've got a great manager, they've got great coaching staff, great infrastructure, but those players as well, in terms of footballing IQ and understanding why they're being asked to do what they're being asked to do, like, it's ridiculous, which is why what we're seeing now, like, for me, it's an absolute privilege, because it's just no way should this ever be Man City, to be honest with you.
Yeah, the game, Sam, that I remember really kind of seeing it properly for, you know, when the penny dropped about how City were actually doing the press was Liverpool Anfield last season. Everyone remembers it as Alisson making mistakes to give the goals away, but it was, the mistakes were forced by the fact that yeah. the way that City was set up, there was no pass on for him. And it was almost a case, I remember Brendan Rodgers in that 5-2 Leicester game saying there's no point in pressing Edison because he's just too good with the ball at his feet. So we cut off the passes and we cut off his avenues of where he could pass it out from. And City were doing that to Alisson at Anfield. And that was the first moment when I realised, actually, it must be so hard to know where you need to be to cut off that avenue, but also not give the goalkeeper so much time to just to be able to sit there with it at his feet and then pick somebody long. It's a really, really disciplined and intelligent way to do it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. And like we did an article at the weekend, actually, me and our new stats guy. He kind of provided all the stats and all the context for them, and I had a look at the, you know, the tactics of it, and it was about pressing, and it kind of spilled over into an idea about our idea of what pressing is. And I wasn't planning on speaking like this today, but that's actually set it up quite well, and I'll try and be succinct. But I did a poll last Thursday or Friday morning asking people, I was speaking to Nadim about this as well, and I did a poll on Thursday morning asking people who they thought pressed City the most between Wolves and Southampton. And I mean, in my mind's eye, I would have said Wolves sat back and parked the bus, Southampton pressed City high.
That's how I voted in your poll, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. And 70% of people agreed. And I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't just me reading the game wrong and going, oh, everyone would think this, and actually it's wrong. Whereas in reality, everyone might have been like, of course that's wrong, you dickhead, kind of thing. So I wanted to check. But yeah, exactly. So there's different ways of pressing, and like there's different definitions as well, and it's pressures. And I'm writing about De Bruyne at the moment, and I just looked at the amount of pressures he made at the weekend, and he made, I think it was 21. And that, the definition of that is you close somebody down, you go within 5 meters of them. That's all it is. It's a pretty broad definition. And the only time he made more was against United. But then you think sometimes, like, there's no point reading too much into that, because there'll be other games where you're not asked to make those pressures. You're asked to stand off. And to go back to the original point of why I tried to go kind of the long way around to get back here is because sometimes the City players, they do have to press, and sometimes they don't. But it's not just City. That's so many teams. But it's so easy, kind of in football punditry, as journalists and fans and whatever we are, to look and try and sum up and go, well, this is a pressing team. But like, so Southampton, they didn't really press City high up. In fact, they pressed City one of the least amounts in any way you can quantify it of any team that could, well, they played City this season. But then they pressed Liverpool the
just
most
remember
at Anfield.
I just remember, though, against Southampton City having no options. I remember the number of times the centre-halves had the ball with nowhere to go.
Yeah. Well, basically, they had, and this is in the article of the weekend, but they had the two strikers basically either side of Fernandinho, so they couldn't go into Fernandinho. But then if the ball did go into Fernandinho, Romeo would run, like, charge into him and press, and then he'd have to try and play a quick pass. But then the Southampton had two midfielders who were on, like, Walker and Cancelo inside. So even if they did get it to him, he had nowhere to go. But then that threat of the press from Romeo, they didn't always have to use it, because they kind of knew, well, if we go to Fernandinho there, then that's the trap. You know, they're just going to snap into him. So we'll do something else. And that's why they couldn't play out. But the press wasn't always necessarily there. But like we say, it's not just, oh, aren't City brilliant? Because sometimes they can do this, sometimes they can do that. Like I say, Southampton didn't really press City in that game. But they really pressed Liverpool. You know, it's different approaches for different games. But yeah, the way City do it, and going back to what Nadim said about the concentration to do it and to do everything right. Because like, if you don't do it once, like this example with Sterling, I saw it on the video on Twitter, De Bruyne had his arms out, like, what the hell's going on? Like, you were supposed to be there. If that goes wrong and they score, then that can be the difference. And that's not to signal to kind of highlight Sterling and say, oh, you should have done this, should have done. It's just how it is. Like that these are the fine margins. And if you start doing that two or three times against a team like Chelsea, they were wasteful on the day. But if that happens more often, you're going to concede. And then you think, when's the pressure going to be even greater than it was on Saturday? And you're thinking the big Champions League games. And against the teams like Borussia Dortmund and PSG last season, where they counter all the time, and Liverpool, the way City have played against Liverpool recently, when Guardiola doesn't want those transitions and it sets the team up to press in that way, to press high against those teams, because like we've just said with Chelsea pressing City, they realise after 90 seconds how difficult it is. City are then doing it against Chelsea, they're doing it against Liverpool, you know, PSG, Dortmund. And to do that, you do need to be switched on all the time. And it is incredible, the work they do off the ball. And like De Bruyne, he had to get the medics on after. So he went on that long bursting run and scored the goal. And then he did one a couple of minutes afterwards. They got the medics on and I saw the medics like signal to Pep. They're like, he's okay. It's just kind of the breathing. He was just knackered. And it was after the Arsenal game. I didn't actually notice this, but my wife did because I had to watch on TV because I couldn't go. When everyone was celebrating and like the cameras were focusing on some of the City players, Fernandinho, who was a sub, had come on and he was in his jacket. He come on and he called the doctors over to De Bruyne because he was knackered then. But we'd noticed in stoppage time he was sprinting down after Ramsdale. So on one hand you just got the work rate and how much you need to sprint, and on the other hand in De Bruyne's case in particular, that fitness is only just coming back now.
Yeah.
You know, 6 months on from the summer, and you know, having COVID at the start of November, I think it was. He's only just getting back to it now. So yeah, there's loads of different interesting things there.
Here's the thing for you. If a team doesn't play out from the back, then how do you press them? So the point with that is like pressing works in some games against some teams
because
they insist upon playing out from the back. But the danger comes when you go up against teams who are happy to then go longer. And I think that's sort of like the matchup in some ways with Liverpool, which can be quite dangerous because they will roll out from the back. But then they also have, say, forwards who want to stretch the line as well. So sometimes if you go too far one way, you then get exposed the other way. And again, like there's the thought of being comfortable on the ball, but then the teams who are comfortable without the ball as well, because they're still dictating the flow of the game. Like sometimes when teams, I think prime example is probably playing against City. At times when City will let teams have possession, they'll have possession around the halfway line and in their own defensive half, as opposed to in key areas. Like I think City are one of the best in terms of having possession in the opposition's territory because of the decision-making and the movement and stuff like that they have. So there is, you know, there's more to it. Like a press isn't necessarily... As Sam said there about Southampton, like, I hold my hands up. Here's a little thing for you. One of the worst feelings you can have when being on a football pitch is when your team has a goal kick and say you're playing centre back and everybody else is marked up except for you.
Yeah, you told me this before. And that was Sarr, wasn't it, really?
The
Jim was mentioning like, they let Sarr have it.
Yeah, it's like they want you to have it. But not necessarily because you're talking
about there must be a reason why they want me to have it.
They've looked at the two centre-backs and said, we'd rather he have it than this other guy. But from there, the issue isn't the fact that he then gets rolled to you, because sometimes they don't come and press you. But what they do is they close off all your options. And now the only person that's free for you is the goalkeeper. So how does that look when you get the ball from the goalie? You come forward about 10 yards because you've got space. If you go forward that 11th yard, all of a sudden everything tightens and you've got like, people are right on your toes, but then you pass it back to the goalkeeper and you hear, from the crowd. it's horrible. It's horrible because you want to be that guy who says, no, I don't care. Just give me the ball. But you're playing into their hands, even though they've not pressed you. Yeah. So there's a lot of nuance that goes on into, say, pressing and just controlling the opposition, you know, when you don't have the ball. And I think the more people sort of pay attention to it, I think the greater you'll see City actually are.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because... We talked on this very briefly a few weeks ago, Sam, about the influence. Guardiola's spoken about it as well, the influence that having fans back in the stadium has. Because when it was behind closed doors, it was kind of laboratory conditions, as one of my friends Dan termed it. Like you have two football teams, they play against each other in the way that they want to play, and the better team tends to win. You don't have 40,000 people sat around you groaning when you make a pass that you know is the pass you should make. but it's not the pass that they want to see. And I just wonder, does it affect your decision-making then?
It certainly can do, but it depends on, say, the manager, the coaches, the other players on the field, because you know you've trained from Monday through Friday and what you're supposed to do on Saturday is the right thing according to that. But say, for example, if a team's moving the ball around the back and it seems like they're under pressure with every pass that gets made, like they would have worked on that for weeks, if not years. But in the crowd, you hear the anxiety, all that stress.
There's a fella behind me who he's been watching Guardiola football now for what, 6 years at City. He's been watching City play it out from the back, and he still will quite often say, "There's nothing wrong with just getting rid of it sometimes."
Exactly, yeah, exactly. You can feel and hear the anxiety in the crowd as something goes on which they're not comfortable with. But the fact is they continue to do it because all the players on the field are comfortable with that and they understand why they're doing it. Because say, for example, if you make it specific to City, they have a goalkeeper whereby like when they roll him the ball, he's just like an extra outfielder. You know, not many teams have that. So people react off that. If he gets the ball at his feet, you've got the wingers who are trying to pull on for diagonals, someone trying to stretch in behind a 10 that's going to drop back in, hoping for a 30-yard ball and all this stuff. And it's like, from the outside, your mind is like blown because you're thinking, what is going on here? Why is he dribbling? Why is he going this way? Like they understand the why and they do it so, so well. And they do it pretty much all of the time. So I think them winning the league last year where there were hardly any fans in for most of the season, I think that would have suited their style of play a lot more than now, because there is something in terms of human nature whereby, you know, you can sense the anxiety and you don't want to make them feel bad, especially if it goes wrong. But in the grand scheme of things, they are champions, they're winners, they're elite players, and they'll continue to do the right thing according to what they're being told and what their teammates expect of them. So I think, you know, for my version of City, yeah, you hear the crowd and you won't come short for a goal kick if the crowd are anxious. But for them, if it's the right thing to do, they'll just continue to do it, whether 50,000 people sound anxious or 50,000 people tell them to do it.
I tweeted about it again, this interview that I quote tweeted at the weekend. And I think it might lead us on to the other big topic we're going to discuss. Or certainly it does in the way I think about it. So, yeah, you've got that thing where you've got the ball at the back or, you know, I remember when we were at Villa, you know, when Bernardo Silva scored that goal at the start of December, Villa were really pissed off because Villa kept trying to play out from the back. The Villa fans were pissed off because the Villa players were trying to play out from the back and kept losing it. And then you could see the grumbles around the stadium. So that's one thing. But the other thing is what Guardiola mentioned, because he mentioned a bit about transitions and how losing against Chelsea when you lose control, it's, you know, a bit of a problem. And the interviewer very perceptively said, well, it was after the goal, wasn't it? For the last 15 minutes, Chelsea put you under a bit of pressure and caused a bit of trouble. And Guardiola, the first thing he was like, yeah, the fans. And like, it wasn't a criticism, but it just goes to show the difference between what the fans and what we expect or hope for from City and what he's telling them and what they're designed to do these days. And he was saying the fans, when Chelsea opened up, so Chelsea made the subs and they'd opened up and they were pushing more anyway. So the spaces opened up to transition. And he said the fans love that. People love to see that in football, whether they're City fans or not, whether they're neutrals, you want to see a kind of open end-to-end game. And he was like, He was saying ultimately he could understand why his players did it, because ultimately those opportunities to transition. You remember when De Bruyne tried to find Sterling for a through ball, he would have been one-on-one. I think Foden tried the same thing and they both got cut out. Ultimately, those things were very understandable decisions to make because the fans were cheering you on and, you know,
go and kill the game, yeah.
Then it's 2-0. But what he wants, he said, you know, the thing what you need to do there is go in, take it into the other half and make 20,000 million passes. And that, for me, is a great example of this, about how the crowd can cheer you on to do things that the manager doesn't necessarily want you to do. But the big thing is, this is what City are now. This is how Guardiola play, and this is how they get that control. Do you remember the Brentford game? When he actually said... Well, I'll paraphrase a bit, but what he said was, he goes, I know people like open games, but he goes, that's no good for us. And that's how they played it. And it was the same kind of thing against Chelsea at the weekend. And all this way of controlling games so there's no transitions, that's how they do it. They don't take, you know, we've been talking for so long about how they don't really counterattack. You know, it's just take the ball and kill it, just slow it down again. And that's what they do. I thought it was really interesting how he mentioned that. And I think it kind of ties into... It's well, the one kind of concession I would give to the our Man City boring debate.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, I was going to move on to the narrative because, Nedim, that is boring, isn't it, if you're not a City fan?
Yeah, but like, so what? Like, just do that. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. This is the thing that gets me, because maybe some City fans are saying it as well, but I'll be honest with you. Like, winning should never be boring, because, or you can call it boring, but losing every single week is horrendous. Like, it's awful. Go into games where your team's constantly losing, they're not playing well. Nobody's wishing for that. And I think the fact that City are doing what they're doing now, I think maybe if someone's to be unhappy from the outside, be unhappy with Liverpool, be unhappy with Chelsea, be unhappy with Man United for the way that they've not been able to compete. Because for me, like, I love this Man City team and I love the players within it, but it's not a team of Galacticos who all came for £500 million each and they were cherry-picked from all the best clubs around the world. But they do perform very, very well. They have a style of play. They believe in each other. They work hard. They're winners. They win games. So, like, someone wants to call City boring. I don't care. A team that wants to control the game is a team that needs to firstly have the mentality to be able to do so, the technique to be able to do so, and the consistency to be able to do so. Like, that's a strength. That's not a weakness. You can call it boring because they win all the time, but there's a reason why they win all the time. And some of those reasons there. Like, other teams can be better. Chelsea City on the weekend is, in some ways for me, an example, because both teams like to control the game through possession. But unfortunately, two teams can't do that at the same time. So they both started off trying to do the same thing, and then Chelsea relented because City were doing it better.
Yeah.
Like, that's not boring. That's a skill in and of itself. So I know people, I don't know, you can call it boring that they're winning, but it only looks bad because the other teams aren't. If Chelsea and Liverpool hadn't drawn and lost some of the games which they'd lost recently, it'd still be a three-team sort of title race. And as a consequence, would City still be boring? And does that mean that Liverpool and Chelsea be boring? Or would it mean that it's a title race, which the neutral would be more interested in? You know, like, what is it? Is it about City?
What is it? Come on.
What do you want? What do you want? A team here? Like, I this is so hard because, you know, being an ex-player, trying to be very respectful to everyone, yeah? But some of the people were saying City did this, City did that, they bought this title, they've done whatever, blah, blah, blah. Within this last 12 games they've been winning, they've had like Nathan Ake at left back, and Nathan Ake was at Bournemouth. And like, he isn't the best player in the Premier League, but he was doing his job for the team and he was invaluable for the team during that time. So when you level some of this criticism at City, like, look at the pieces within it itself. And a lot of those pieces, in my opinion, they've earned the right to be discussed as being really top players. But then Kevin De Bruyne didn't work at Chelsea. You look at, say, Gundogan 2 years ago, nobody was really having him. Rodri, when he came in, no one liked him because they preferred Fernandinho. You've got John Stones there, who some people say, oh, he shouldn't play for England, shouldn't do this. Like, what are people... Sorry, I've gone here.
It's fine. The only other one I was going to chuck in was the one I hear. I still, to this day, hear all the time that Raheem Sterling is overrated and scores tapping. And it's like, what are you watching?
Even if you want to create a compilation video of his tappings, I'll create a compilation video of balls that have gone into the box and your wingers at your football clubs haven't been there. And I'll ask you the question, why? Why are they not there? And it's because they don't have what he has, which is that huge desire to go in and affect a game in a positive manner. People make it seem like he's running. He gets just to the head of the queue with three other City players to get the tap-ins, like he's fighting them for it. Like, he's doing his job like everybody else is, the same way the person that squared the ball into the six-yard box, the same way the person that played the ball for the person who's going to play the ball into the six-yard box. They're doing their job for the team, and they're doing it to the highest of standards, which is why these are all consequential players within the history of the Premier League. And for me, like, just what is wrong with that? Like, what's the problem? If, yeah. I've fully done it. Like I said, I think City have got some incredible players, but all the players within that team have earned the respect that they have right now based on how they've played, because not every signing has to be a success. And the people who they brought in, I don't think there's ever really been a point, in my opinion, where they brought somebody in and as a consequence, that meant that they're definitely going to win the Premier League. Like, when you look at the start of this season, Chelsea did well. They won the Champions League, finished the season really well, and they brought in Lukaku. Lukaku, that's it now. They've made it. This is going to be the start for them. And he's a very good player, but like, what was that with City this year? Was bringing in Jack Grealish to come, that was it now. Everything's said and done. This is it. Well, no, it wasn't, because come the start of the year, everyone's like, well, they missed out on this, so it means they're not going to do that. They drew with Southampton. Yeah, they washed up. They're not going to score enough goals, this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. Here we are. Yeah. 13 points from Chelsea. Like, what do you want? If they bought if they bought Salah this summer, and then they bought flipping, I don't know, Chelsea Kante, and then they went to United and bought Pogba or something like that, and they're doing that every season, I'd say, yeah, cool, Bayern Munich. But they're not that. So as a consequence, like, just, excuse my French, but just shut up.
Yeah. Sam, the
that
question...
French. I'll show you some French.
I know, I was going to say something drastic, and I was like... Actually, I say film Tygo. How about that for you?
I don't know what that means. So fantastic. I know Firmin Lebouche, yeah. Sam, the question that I have about all of this criticism that comes City's way is, why do so many people who aren't City fans seem to think it's City's job to entertain them?
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't mean to set up, well, I thought you were going to set up the chat, but the way it went, you know, we went into it that way. So my kind of preamble was going to be, nobody needs to know or work out if I find City boring or not. Because if you listen to this podcast, chances are it's not your first time and you know I really enjoy it. And if you see my tweets on a match day, you know I'm having fun. So, yeah. But I mean, the one thing I can see people saying, oh, they're boring, is because, look, if you're given a choice to watch a game that's end-to-end and there's going to be five goals or like a coaching masterclass, most people are going to say, I'll go with the end-to-end, which, you know, can be a masterclass as well, but not in the way the paper. So I get it. So like I say, Guardiola at this moment in time, and it is quite interesting, the way he's kind of gone, I don't know, is there a way he's kind of turned attacking football defensive in a sense? But, you know, for all the reasons we were talking about even before the boring debate came into view, like, that it's incredible the way they play, and I appreciate that. So I think part of it is, and it's impossible not to sound snobby here because I'm by no means a kind of tactical football understanding genius, but I do think a lot of it is, oh, well, they've got loads of money, so obviously they're going to play well. Like, people just don't understand how difficult it is to do what they do. And what Nathan was saying before, and what we were saying before about what they do off the ball and how concentrated they are, you know, I think that's easy to take for granted. So people have got no kind of appreciation of how good it is, I would say. But I think the main thing is, like, to go back to your question, like, oh, was any City fans listening to this, tuning into Liverpool every week when they were winning the title, playing really well? No. Like, you don't want your rivals to win and play well. And when they do play well, you don't necessarily tune in because it's great football. Like, the point's been made this week that, you know, people would rather watch Man United, and it's not necessarily, oh, they'd rather watch Man United because they're good, but it's because they're mad. Like, if Man United are playing, I dare say now, there's a lot of City fans who'll be quite happy to watch United games these days, because there's chances are they're not going to win, and it could be a shambles. Whereas, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there's no way you'd be watching United on the telly. If they're on, there's no way, because they'd be winning. And that's it. It's just people who are sick of City winning.
Well, here's my pop psychology about it all.
So they just come up with whatever shit they can find to discredit it, but go on.
Well, my pop psychology about it is, and this is thinking out loud, so I could be way wide at the market, but I wonder how many of these people are simply fans of teams that were successful when they were growing up. And, you know, when we're kids, you think everybody's experience is the same as your own. So if your team is winning, you think everybody else is enjoying your team winning as well. And so now when you're a bit older, you look back at it and you think, well, everybody enjoyed it back then when we were winning, but nobody's enjoying it now. And actually, nobody was enjoying it other than the fans of the teams that were winning back then either. It's just that that's not how you remember it. And I just wonder if that's the way it is.
Yeah, I see that. And you're probably right. You're probably right. Because like if you love Liverpool, you're not going to like Man United, you're not going to like Man City in this current phase. If you love Chelsea, like you think your team's the best. It's that sort of naive fan view of their team. This is the best football club in the land. We should be winning this. We work really hard. We should do whatever. Like, that's not the way it works. And I think the fact that City are rolling over teams week in, week out, that's frustrating them. And it's no surprise to me that probably one of the most watched City games was, in probably in terms of late viewership, was probably when City were playing Arsenal. And there was probably talk that City were on the back foot and they weren't playing well. And there was a chance for Arsenal to go and beat Man City. And all of a sudden, Arsenal represented every team that hates Man City, or rather hates the team that's doing really, really well.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, the conversation's off the back of it. Oh, it's a robbery. It's this, it's that. Like, everybody took that personally. But not many people were talking about it through the sort of prism of Arsenal. They were talking about it more through the fact that they don't like Man City. Oh, City have paid off the league. They've paid off the refs.
Yeah, in fairness, I did think they burgled the points that day. But no,
listen. So did I. So did I. But in the same breath, they did defend well in certain moments, and it shows. This is that cliche game where everyone says, "Well, this is what champions are made of: a day when they don't play well, but they get a result." But like I say, it was all the stuff afterwards. It was more anti-City than pro-Arsenal, even though, you know what I mean? Do you get where I'm coming from?
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of hate that was able to be vented from certain people who didn't have an affinity to Arsenal but have a certain disdain for Man City. That kind of shows the situation that they're in at this moment.
Yeah. Sam, is this basically, have we been heading always to this point anyway? Because there's very little else you can say about City. And Nedham just spent, you know, a good while of this show talking about how they've put together a team that works for each other, and that all the players, all the different parts of the team work really well, but might not necessarily be the best version of that player that you could get elsewhere, that sort of thing. Is it basically that there's nothing else you can say about City these days other than, you know, they've spent a lot of money and they control games really well?
Yeah, there's a couple of points there. I think, like I say, the appreciation's there. And I think one of the points there, and look, if this had been me and you having this conversation, David, I think it would have been, I would have been a lot, you know, I'd have been having the kind of rants like Nedham has. But I mean, he's fulfilled that role. And I feel the same. But I think when you're talking about Nathan Ake there, and this is just me playing devil's advocate, which I'm sure, Nedham, you'll appreciate, because, you know, that's most of our conversations.
Basically.
But people will say, well, he costs 40 million. And that's not me saying that. But the point of view is, and so, like, in terms of what you were saying there, Mooney, in terms of they've spent a lot of money and they control games really well, and there's not a lot to say.
The Grealish thing is always, not everyone can spend 100 million for a player that's not going to start the game. You hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that is a fact. Like, my thing with the Grealish valuation is, it's not that he costs 100 million, so he should be doing this and he should be doing that. It's, if there is a conversation, it's City are in such a position now where they don't need a 100 million pound player to do what everyone would expect a 100 million pound player to do. They don't need that. A 100 million pound player to Man City, because of how well they've done everything else and built their squad, does not have to come in and say, like Lukaku, does not have to come in and say, okay, well, we're winning something now. He just comes in and goes, well, you just do your job and you happen to cost this money, which they've got. Yeah, so there is a slight difference there with that one. But yeah, it's to go back to this whole devil's advocate point, but you know, it's the money, isn't it? It's the money that's spent. And it's two sides of the same coin. So Miguel Delaney wrote an article last weekend, and I was speaking to a mate about it, who's a City fan, he was like, it's sort of like a backhanded compliment, isn't it? And it's like, I read it, and a lot of the things in there are like, they're facts, or it's fair to say. But it kind of depends on your perspective. And it's like, I couldn't disagree with a lot of that. You know, I could with some, but that's fine. It's not a criticism of his work. And, you know, he'll read my article and I'm sure he'll probably disagree with even more. But there's one element to it of, in terms of how well they've built things, I am convinced the difference is Guardiola.
Yeah.
And I think that point has been made a bit on Twitter the last few days as well. You know, City had the most expensive squad and these kind of advantages when Mancini and Pellegrini were there. And okay, it's further down the line. So you could argue the more money you spend, the closer you're going to be to getting it right. And there is certainly evidence for that, just in terms of how football works. The more money you spend and the higher your wage, well, the closer you're going to be to the top of the table. So it's hard to get away from that. But I think it goes back to the appreciation, because this isn't just a good team. This is a great, that all-time great Premier League team. And I don't think without Guardiola, you're getting an all-time great Premier League team. I remember tweeting like the couple of days after they got knocked out by Monaco and Chelsea were going to win the league, because this is Pep's first season. I was like, look, what Chelsea are doing is good. And like to win the title with wingbacks and whatever, how Conte's doing it is good, but it's not especially memorable. I was like, what City want to do is be remembered. Like they want to do something special. Guardiola's not going to change his ways to come back to the mean of the Premier League. He wants to do it his way, and therefore he wants to do it in a way that is going to make this City team one of the most memorable. Well, that's what they want to do, and that is what they've done. But without Guardiola, it's not happening.
Yeah.
It's just not. Like he's managed to keep those players in a frame of mind where, and we've talked about this before, I'm not saying everyone loves him and he's a man management genius, because he's not especially popular, but you know that I think that's the case at a lot of top clubs. But he's got the respect, and he's got whatever it is that the players go, oh, I wish I'd play more, but fuck me, when I do play, I'm going to do the job. And he's fostered this mentality where no big players are left, really. Sane didn't, you know, that didn't go particularly well. But despite some grumbles and some wanting to go, and yeah, maybe if the market had been different, more players would have gone. But they all go out there and do their thing on the pitch. And I remember saying when we did that podcast after the Champions League final, trying to explain the view towards the manager, it's so different to what we expect. Because if you think four or five players in the dressing room aren't just unhappy but want to go, you're thinking that's late stage Mourinho, where, you know, it's a team that's in crisis and everybody wants to go. But that's not the case. You know, there is that, but they've still managed to fit everything together, and there's no point in me explaining what they do on the pitch, because we talked about it for the Chelsea game. They just do that every week. Or if it's the Arsenal game, they do it in a different way. Or it's a Liverpool game, they do it in a different way. Or if it's a team that's going to go longer, they'll just sit off more. They're so adaptable. They are so good. So people will say, and I've been talking for what was that average time of our show? 3 days.
3 days, yeah.
Something. But like, people will say it's about the money, and the other thing in that article is it's like a, it's a project that it can't be replicated. Newcastle can't replicate it now because there's FFP now, and it's, I do get that. But then you go down the rabbit hole of, you know, was FFP just set up to stop City doing this, and is that right? Is that wrong? Blah blah blah. Which we're not going to go into again. That would be another 3 day podcast. but this is what people who don't necessarily like City, or at least if they. It's not about like, it's just about the state of football at the moment. It's about, the quote was, if this is how you'd imagine, if you could imagine how a state-backed project would look, this is it. And it's like, in terms of the money and the precision and stuff, I kind of get that, but like, there's another state-backed project at PSG and they're not this. Like, and it's like, it's not just Guardiola, because just saying it's Guardiola is a difference. It kind of plays down what, you know, Ferran Soriano's vision off the pitch and Cheeky Beguirestein. And it doesn't, because they would still have the City Football Group. But without Guardiola at the head of it, it's just not the same. And I've said this before, I said this the other week, like maybe when Pep goes, if the new manager comes in and they keep blitzing everything, then either the new guy's a genius as well, or maybe I was wrong. And you know, you could get a few coaches who can do it. But I'm convinced it's Guardiola that makes that difference. And like, okay, you could pump unlimited funds, and look, nobody else is going to be able to do that now. Newcastle won't be able to get sponsors from companies in Saudi Arabia because there's that new Premier League related party rule. And City fans would say, look, the Premier League cartel are doing it to Newcastle now. They're not going to let them get to the top of the table. So no other teams can do that. But also, you can't just give anyone. You can't give us £3 billion and say, well, start an offer. How are you going to do that? We're not going to put somebody on the moon.
Yeah, that's the, what you said there is the point which I've been thinking in my mind now. And it's so difficult to be able to do this. But as a concept, I think this might work out. So if you look at the players that City have now, like the argument about the money that they've spent, it's a fair argument. They've spent money. But in all those windows where they brought in these players who are now exceptional for this football club, ask yourself if they were the obvious players to sign in that window and in that time. And if you had the money yourself for your respective club, is that what you'd expect your team to be able to do as well?
Yeah. Ruben Dias was the, what, third choice, fourth choice?
Exactly. And there are the players like that. Like, these are good players that City are bringing in, but they're not like this overall, they're not distinctly obvious superstars who everybody was fighting for at any given moment. Like, say, if City buy Haaland or someone in the summer, that's a whole different conversation. But for the other people which they're bringing in people who complement who they are at this moment. And as a consequence, those guys, they come in, I'm not saying they're bad players, but they don't come in as superstars. But then all of a sudden they fit into the system and they thrive within that with the abilities and stuff that they have. And they start to look really, really good. Like, look at, say, I don't know, this one's just coming off the top of my head. But Raheem Sterling for Man City, when he's playing at his best, he's basically invaluable in my opinion. But then if he was to come for sale in the summer, how many teams in England will go for him? So then what's his value? Is somebody more valuable when they're in the side as opposed to when they're on the open market?
Yeah.
But yeah. There we go.
So my final question for today's show, Nedim, and I'll throw it to you. Should City fans care if everybody else says they're boring? Should City fans care? We're winning all the time. We're playing good football. We enjoy it. Who cares what people think?
I think you obviously will care, because it's always nice when you feel you belong to a nice product and other people say it's nice too. But, you know, this is England. This is the Premier League. And like, teams that dominate aren't necessarily liked by a lot of people. Prime example at this moment, if I can be completely honest here, is the amount of people that are enjoying seeing Man United struggle at this moment in time. You know, through the 90s when they were dominant. And now, like, I'm seeing everybody's really enjoying seeing them go collapse against Villa, enjoying them lose against this team, that team, and so on and so forth. So I think you'd want your team to be respected more, but the success that City have right now means that, you know, nobody's neutral. I'm going to say nobody's neutral. But people will pretend to be happy with it, but they're just waiting for the moment where you're not at the top anymore, especially because the gap at times seems like it's so far away from everybody else. But the fact is, I think for anyone who's associated with City, who enjoys watching them, who enjoys this Pep version of City and the success that they have, is make the most of it, because I can't see how it gets better. And as a consequence, it means that at some point in the future, it will get worse. So whether people like it, dislike it from the outside, I think we should make the most of it, because it's truly, truly special. Like, to talk about this run that they're on now, the stat was that I think under Pep, they've had four spells where they've won 10 games in a row. I think it is during his tenure, at least 10 games in a row. And then the next in line after that is somebody with two, and then the drop down goes to like five games and stuff like that. So this is objectively the like most... they say in America, like, winningest manager for a season or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's not normal to be sitting here after they've won 12 league games in a row and talking and just looking out like everything's normal. Like, that's a real blessing, because most teams through history will never, ever come close to that. So what other people think, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. People will hate you because you're successful, and they'll say you bought it, you did this, you did that. But in fairness to the club, they did it their way. They did it how they saw it. The manager's done it how he sees it. And as a consequence, you're getting the best version of that product itself. And that product itself wouldn't work everywhere, but it's working for Man City. So take pride in that. And yeah, if someone wants to say otherwise, just ask them, if you had £1 billion, would this be the team that you'd assemble? And the likelihood is they would say no. So yeah, there's something special about that, in my opinion.
Like, from a coaching point of view, because obviously Nedim gives a player's point of view, and I'm sure he could give like a coaching one as well, because it's the same kind of thing. But like I mentioned last week, how there's loads of guys around with like UEFA Pro licenses and stuff who, you know, they're not Premier League managers. And the idea of going to another country and standing in front of a group of players and saying, we're going to play this way, and then them doing it, is that would be a fucking huge success. But then does it? When you go from Barcelona, going to Bayern Munich, I'd imagine, this is a bit of a straw man argument because I don't actually know, but I'd imagine there was a bit of, oh, I wonder how he will get on at another country. You know, he hasn't got all the Barca players now, it's a different style. Adapted to that style, adapted what he did, adapted to his methods, and got them playing fantastic football his way. And yeah, they kept on winning. And you can either keep saying they kept winning the Bundesliga or he didn't win the Champions League, whichever you want to do. He got a new group of players playing his style. And then it came to the Premier League, and I now know for a fact there was definitely people saying it's not going to work. It is working. Like, as a coach, purely to get players to do what you want is the achievement in itself. And then what you want is actually amazing football that people love watching, and it wins trophies. Like, people, again, it's like the better City are, the easier it looks. And I think that's the issue people don't understand. They're too good for people to comprehend. And then you get other things like chucked in as well. Like, oh, you know, well, if something doesn't work for City, then they'll just sell him and get another one. It's like that happened with Edison, and that's it. That happened with Bravo and Edison, and it hasn't happened since. How many times have City bought in a player and they've gone, oh, well, it's not work, fuck off, we'll bring someone else in? It's that. It's Bravo and Edison. But yeah, it's the how as much as anything. Like, that success as a coach to go and be able to do that. And again, people think, oh, wow, he's coaching a big club and big player, so it's easy. In some ways, I'm not saying it is harder, because I'm sure people who have only managed in the Football League would say, fucking hell, I'd love to have those players. But it's this idea of, oh, when's, you know, Sean Dyche going to get a big job kind of thing, which you'd hear said before. It's like, you need to manage the big egos. You need to play the type of football that the big players want to play. And how many times have we seen it when a manager goes into a dressing room at a big club and they last about 6 months? At Real Madrid, it happens every couple of years. You need to go in and be capable of managing those players just on a kind of day-to-day basis, let alone the football. And yeah, Guardiola's brought all that together. The club's brought it all together in the way that, like I said earlier, it might sound ridiculous, and people who aren't City fans might listen to that bit I said about Grealish and say it's ridiculous, but it's true. The squad's built in a way that a £100 million player doesn't need to add 20 goals.
Yeah.
He just needs to come in and add another option. And to be fair, they probably thought Bernardo was going anyway, so it was a bit of a replacement anyway. But yeah, the boring thing, I'm going to write about it next week. I don't know how I'm going to kind of boil it down to 1,200 words or whatever, but it's just like, it basically just comes down to opposition people not liking what you do. But what did I say in March when City were on that 20-odd game winning run? In terms of City fans, just enjoy it. Like Nadim said, like it's as good as it gets. Don't worry so much about what other people are saying on Twitter. And I know it probably grates more when it's not just rival fans, but there's journalists saying it as well. But like there's plenty of good stuff being written about City and how good they are as well. So try and enjoy that, and you'll have a good 6 months until the end of the season.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to an end of the 100th episode of Wire With Us. Thank you to our guest for this week, Nedim Manua.
Oh, sorry, I didn't know it was 100th episode. Congratulations, guys. And thanks
thank you very much. We do apologise to everybody who's listened for all this time. Thank you for sticking to us. Sam, here's to the next 100.
Yeah. That's why I got Nadim on, just to get him involved in a 100th show. Give him a taster.
Oh, cheers, mate. Cheers, Sam. It's very kind of you, mate.
That's all right. You'll get there one day.
Nah, it's probably not going to happen. So, yeah. I'm happy with 99 Noel Gallagher. That's fine. That's plenty for me, mate.
We'll see. Nedim, knowing who you've got lined up for it, if it comes off, I do hope you get there anyway. So fingers crossed for you, mate. Don't forget, you can sign up to The Athletic right now with a 33% discount. Just use the code MANCITYPOD.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.